Good evening and welcome back to Foundations. Jeff, come on, take a seat, buddy. Good to have you guys. Man, you're just an easy target. You're an easy target. So good to have you guys join us tonight for Foundations. My word, I'm actually happy to see a lot of you back because last week we began our six-week study of the history of the Christian church. And as you well know, this is all new material, I trust, for the great majority of you. And it is admittedly kind of complicated. There's a lot of historical reference, a lot of events and people, places that I trust the vast majority of you aren't terribly familiar with. And so the troubling thing, the difficult thing about going to a class like this when you don't have any familiarity is everything's new. So the next hour that I talk, you're going to be like, oh my word, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. And you're trying to stack it all together and you feel a little lost. So just by way of reminder, two things I want you to know. One, we record all of these. There's a camera on me right now. We post them on the church website on our YouTube page. So if I talk too fast or you miss a note or you just have no idea what I meant when I said that, you can go back and review it. The notes we have published tonight on the tables, we publish them in PDF format as well online. So you can find all of that on the church website. And then let me just say as a final word before we dive in tonight, some of you may be wondering, is this really worth our time? Like, I'm not going to remember half of what you say, and don't you think I should study the Bible? Why do I need to study this? And let me just say, at the very least, you should pay attention because you're never going to hear this again. This is just not taught commonly. Candidly, most pastors don't feel well-versed enough in church history to teach it. Now, I have taken a lot of church history over my years, but nevertheless, you guys need to know it takes twice as long for me to prep a Foundations lesson in church history than it does to write a sermon for Sunday morning. I'm in the Bible every day of the week for the last 20 years. I'm not in church history books much. So I had to prep a lot to get all of this put together, and I have done my best tonight to try to slice and dice it up so that you guys can, Lord willing, digest where we're going tonight. Now, to know where we're going, let's remember where we just were in our study of church history. Does anybody recall that last week we encountered the great hinge of all church history, the pivotal event upon which everything in church history turns, what is known as the great Protestant Reformation? If you recall, the church, since the days of Christ, since the New Testament, was one great big universal church. There's another word for this phrase, universal church. That phrase is Catholic, small c, Catholic church. But as you may recall from our previous studies of early church history and Middle Ages church history, that Catholic church got perverted and became capital R, Roman, capital C, Catholic Church. It was no longer just merely a universal church. It became a very distinctly corrupt organization called the Roman Catholic Church. Well, the corruption that had come within the Roman Catholic Church, both with the leaders and all the craziness that went with the papal offices, and then as well as all the theological errors that we studied last week, you know, paying money to get your loved ones out of purgatory or doing all these things to get good with God again, all this crazy stuff that they were teaching, things that they teach, by the way, to this day. Like if you go to a service, which they call the Mass, if you show up there, Jesus' body and blood are being sacrificed and poured out yet again for you, which of course we as evangelical Protestants would say, that is not what the Bible teaches. The Reformation started to have some rumblings because the church just continued to get perverted. Something else began to happen. Since the church was so perverted, it began to have an impact on all of the known Christian world, because in that day, Christianity and the state were one. We are of a heritage that believes in the separation of the two. Back in that day, it was so close that do you know what they actually called the Roman Empire of that day? The Holy Roman Empire, because it was led both by an emperor and by a pope, so to speak. These two were basically co-leading this great empire together. So Christianity actually became known as Christendom. which is a combination of the word Christianity and kingdom. It essentially had come together into this one political Christian mass, which folks, you probably know, if you studied any of this at all, that Christianity or religion in general, when it gets co-opted into politics, into government, they're not good bedfellows. It doesn't work out. It is a recipe for trouble. And often when those two lay in bed together, the result is a child that we ought to have a great problem with. And you want to know what that child is? It's what we call cultural Christianity. Cultural Christianity is not Christianity. It is Christianity in name only. It is going to church because that's what you do culturally. It is not, in other words, any meaningful, real relationship with the Lord. Consequently, the great masses of so-called Christianity in this age of Christendom, in this pre-Reformation era, nobody looked like Christ. They were all horrible people doing what you would expect pagans to do, but they did it in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so last week we learned that there was finally a breaking point. There was a German monk, a man named Martin Luther, who started to read the Bible for himself and realized what the Bible said was different than what the Pope and all of the Roman Catholic Church was teaching. And so he protested. He wrote down 95 problems he had with the church, nailed it to the door of his church in Wittenberg, Germany, and then that sparked the Protestant Reformation. What we need to ask ourselves tonight is, what happened next? Like, we consider ourselves Protestants. We protest the Roman Catholic Church to this day. We are in that great stream of Protestant Christianity. So how did we get from Martin Luther to Hickory Grove Baptist Church, a Southern Baptist congregation as a part of American evangelicalism in the 21st century? What happened from there to there? We're going to go step by step or century by century to build up in these next 6 weeks to our present century. Actually, we're going to stop short and just do the 20th century because the 21st century, we're only 23 years into it at this point. Can't write the history books on it yet. Tonight, we're going to turn a page. Last week, we looked at the years 1500 to 1599, what is known as the 16th century. Tonight, we are going to look at the year 1600 to 1699, what is known as the 17th century. And as we do, I want you to see one significant thing. The Reformation continues. The theme of last week is going to be the theme tonight. And I want you to see three simple truths as we study this 17th century tonight. On your notes, you'll notice, I wrote this so simply your child could understand the theme we're going to pursue tonight. I want you to see that in this 17th century, the Reformation grows, it slows, and it goes somewhere. It even rhymes. You guys are going to think about that in your dreams tonight. The Reformation grows, slows, and it ends up going somewhere. Let's begin with what happened to this Reformation spirit. Where did it go? How was it growing? Well, the first thing I want you to note is that the Reformation began to grow in all these theological ways. It grew, in other words, theologically. You began to see all these people begin to debate hotly what they believed. So no longer was there one guy over the whole universal church saying, right, wrong. There was now a whole bunch of people that said, I don't agree with the Pope, and I don't agree with you. I think this is what the Bible teaches. And so what begins to happen? Well, it's not a shock. You begin to see what was once a unified mass begin to splinter, and to splinter, and to splinter into what we now know today as denominations. Let's just very briefly look at some of the denominations that began to splinter from the Roman Catholic Church. The first major denomination you see splinter off from the Roman Catholic Church eventually became known as Lutheranism, followers of Martin Luther. Now, he hated that. He did not want to be. He would have turned over in his grave had he known that his followers adopted his name. He even had a protege, a man who came after him named Philip Melanchthon, and some of the folks that liked Philip Melanchthon better than Martin Luther, they called themselves Philippists, and then the other people were the Lutherans. It's ridiculous how they were following these names. The Lutherans were the first major denomination that broke off. They had some distinguishing beliefs. one of which was that they believed not in what Catholics call transubstantiation, which is a technical word that means when you take the Lord's Supper, Jesus' body and blood are literally there. You were eating it and drinking it. He believed in what's called consubstantiation, which is a technical word that basically means when you are taking the Lord's Supper, Jesus is right there. You're not eating him. You're not drinking him, but he is right next to it. We're going to come back in a little bit as to why we don't even believe that either. That is a distinguishing mark between us and the Lutherans. The first denomination starts to locate itself in Germany and even in the Scandinavian regions. Then you see another denomination begin to break off. This was led by a man named Ulrich Zwingli, and he led a denomination that we kind of generally would call a Reformed denomination. He was in Switzerland, and he had some debates with Martin Luther, and he kind of gave his own little flavor on some things. He was a little more radical than Martin Luther. He thought Martin Luther was too cozy with the Catholic Church, because remember, Martin Luther was a former priest of the Catholic Church, and he thought Martin Luther was too okay with everything that went with Catholicism, so he went a little further. And then after he died, he had an heir that came after him who was a little bit more sober. His name was John Calvin, and John Calvin was a brilliant man who put into writing everything that Zwingli taught and more. In fact, his book, The Institutes of the Christian Religion, is one of the greatest books in Christian history. You ought to go buy it. It really is a fantastic read. It's amazing. John Calvin was one of the greatest minds of the Reformation era. You got the Lutherans. You got the Reformed. Those Reformed were largely in Switzerland and the Netherlands and France. Then you had a guy named John Knox, who brought Christianity and a particular taste of it, a flavor of it, to Scotland. And that flavor is what we would know today as Presbyterianism. Presbyterianism comes from the word presbyteros, which is referring to a specific type of church government. What distinguishes Presbyterians from a great many other denominations is how they organize the staff, the leadership of their church. That began largely in Scotland. Then you had a denomination pop up in England. This, and we're going to tell this story in a little bit. The denomination that began in England is what was officially referred to as the Church of England, but you would know it today largely as either an Anglican church or an Episcopal church. Those two words basically describe subsets of the Church of England. And then lastly, our great heritage of faith, the Baptists. We're going to conclude our study tonight by learning how on earth did the Baptists come into being? Why are we Baptists today? We'll learn that at the end of our study tonight. The Reformation was growing theologically. It was dividing out all over the place. But it was also growing politically, which might shock you because you're like, wait, I thought this was Christianity. What does Christianity have to do with politics here? Why would the Protestant Reformation inform politics? Oh, watch what happened. There was a group of reformers that thought all the other reformers were too cozy with the state. All the reformers that sought to reform the church and still use the state to help them do it were called magisterial reformers. That's a word that refers to the magistrates who helped enforce Christianity. John Calvin, for example, was one of these. But there was another group that was more radical. They decided, no, the church needs to be completely separate from the state. The church and the state have no business being together. We need to reform the church so much that it has no strings attached to the state anymore. These people were called the radical reformers. Now, why would we call that radical? Because most of you are looking at me thinking, that seems pretty normal. I feel like the magisterial reformers, they're the radical, ridiculous ones. Well, remember, the church and the state were still connected back then. And so if you had a group of people saying, hey, the church needs to be separated from the state, that sounded like anarchy. That sounded like rebellion. So these people that were saying, God has told us not to do this, we are in violation of God's law, they viewed that as a radical thing. And so you began to see this rise of one group that became particularly infamous for this belief. They read the Bible, and they realized, wait a minute, you're not born into the church. You're born a sinner, and once converted, only then do you enter the church. You shouldn't baptize a baby. you shouldn't be baptized until you profess faith in Christ. So they, upon learning that, having been baptized as babies, decided we need to be rebaptized. We need to make a profession of faith and then be baptized. And do you know what they were called? Anabaptists. Anna means re-baptists, re-baptizers. The Anabaptists were those who decided infant baptism is not legitimate. We need to be baptized again. Now, they started out easy enough. They were, you know, we don't think this is right. We think our doctrine is right and you're wrong. But as is often the case, they got real militant about it. And before long, they got so militant that they became violent and they began fighting people over this doctrine. I mean, imagine, it's crazy. They became revolutionary such that the wider Holy Roman Empire viewed the Anabaptists as a revolutionary, radical, subversive group of people and began to kill them and persecute them to keep them from causing all of this anarchy. So eventually they waved the white flag, and guess what they ended up becoming? Like any smart person, all right, well, if we fight, we're not going to get anywhere. We're just going to be killed. So let's do the other thing. Let's become pacifists. And all the Anabaptists ended up becoming known for pacifism. They just didn't fight at all. And they ended up kind of coexisting within the Holy Roman Empire. The Anabaptists. Now, some of you are thinking, Kyler, are we from the Anabaptists? Are we? I mean, you use the word Baptist, and we believe that an infant baptism isn't legitimate. Are we from that great stream of Anabaptists? And my answer is, kinda. We're going to come back to why I said kinda in just a moment. The Anabaptists. I want to tell you about one Anabaptist, though, that I think you're going to recognize his name. There was one Anabaptist who was particularly well known. He took all the New Testament seriously. He embraced Anabaptism. He thought you needed to be baptized again. He was a Dutch Catholic priest, and his name was Menno Simons. And there was a sect, a denomination of Christianity that was named after him. What denomination would come from a guy named Menno? The Mennonites. The Mennonites come from this man named Menno Simons, who so read the New Testament that he thought everything needed to be exactly the way it was portrayed. I mean, if you know the Mennonite culture, it is a distinctly countercultural denomination that abides to this day. I want you to see that the Reformation was growing, both theologically, denominations everywhere. Politically, these radical reformers like the Anabaptists and the Mennonites were popping up. It also began to grow intellectually. It's not just theologically. There was actually an intellectual bent to this Reformation that began to grow. During this era, they began to write down what they believed, because no longer did the Catholic priest and pope, no longer was his word good enough. We had to figure out, well, what do we actually believe? So they began to write books and books and books and books. And then as people got books and began to read books, they wanted to write more books about the books that they just read about the book. And they read and they wrote and they read and they wrote. And they began to build this great corpus, this great library of theology. And this era of Christian history, where all this theological writing began to be developed, is called Protestant Scholasticism. Which you may be somewhat familiar with that word, scholasticism. It refers to this educational, this literally this school. And it is a term, a technical term that means it was an era where Protestants really thought deeply, intellectually about what the Bible said. Now here's the problem. I believe that God gave us a mind, that we must use it to our utmost ability. I believe in theology books. If you have ever been to my office here at Hickory Grove, I have more books than all the other pastors here combined. I've got like 4,000 of them up in that office. I believe in this. But here is my great warning to you. It is very dangerous to let your faith become merely an intellectual enterprise. And that is what started to happen during this era. The Reformation led some to just become so consumed with doctrinal minutiae that they began to be heartless, cold intellects. They could tell you exactly what the hypostatic union is in the Bible, but they had no love for Jesus Christ. So Protestant scholasticism was good and bad. It was bad in that it could create some cold-hearted Christianity, But what was good is it developed a lot of doctrinal statements that helped us understand what we believe. For example, there was in this era the rise of what you might call confessionalism, which is a technical word that means all these confessions of faith began to be written. Did you guys know Hickory Grove has a confession of faith? Our church abides by a statement that summarizes what we believe the Bible teaches. It is entitled The Baptist Faith and Message 2000. You can go find it on our church website. Every Southern Baptist church adheres to this statement of faith. But this statement of faith is not the first one that was ever written. As early as this Reformation era, indeed earlier, there were statements being written. And during this era, you see a lot of famous ones. You don't have to write this down, but for example, during this era, you saw statements like the Augsburg Confession, the Belgic Confession. You saw the... Siri is talking to me. You saw the London Baptist Confession of Faith. You saw the Westminster Standards. All these famous statements that you can go Google and find today were all written during this era because there was this great effort to wrap your mind around what does the Bible say? I can't listen to the Pope anymore. I can't listen to the priest anymore. I need to go to the Bible myself and figure out what does this book say? The Reformation was growing, my friends. It was growing theologically, denominations everywhere. It was growing politically. You're starting to see these radicals pop up. It was growing intellectually. You started to see all of these confessions be written. But there was a movement, even within Protestantism, that recognized, okay, did we really trade Roman Catholicism for this cold-hearted intellectual religion? Is that what this is? Is Christianity a religion of smart people? There was a movement within Protestantism that said, wait, Christianity is not head knowledge. It is a relationship with a living Christ. There was, in other words, a turn away from the scholastic, heady, intellectualized faith and a turn towards piety. It's what we call pietism. There was a turn towards spirituality. There was a turn towards we need to devotionally follow the Lord. The Reformation grew, in other words, spiritually, in this rise of what we call pietism. Let me explain what happened with pietism. There were a group of people that started to realize, okay, if you believe the right thing, but you don't do the right thing, Jesus is going to spit you out of his mouth. You need to have right belief and right practice, orthodoxy and orthopraxy. In other words, I'm not going to heaven because I simply intellectually assent to the right things. My life must be transformed by those things that I claim to believe. And so there was a group of people that began to seek the Lord earnestly. There was, for example, a group called the Moravians. Anybody ever heard of the Moravians? The Moravians were an early pietistic group that emphasized devotional life. I bet everybody in this room is familiar with this pietistic group. Anybody ever heard of the Methodists? How many of you were former Methodists, perhaps current Methodists? The Methodists, started largely by John and Charles Wesley, some brothers, this was a group that focused on a method of following the Lord. They emphasized small groups, the devotional life within small groups together. And then this ultimately led to something that we are all the product of. How many of you, by show of hands in this room tonight, either were personally or a member of your family was personally impacted by the ministry of Billy Graham? It's quite common in any room, particularly in Charlotte, North Carolina, to have that. Billy Graham is the great high priest. That's a terrible word. I'm just saying that right now. He is the utmost example of what we would call revivalism. And that began in this century, this revivalistic impulse to go and see people's minds not merely turn to the Lord, but their hearts turn to the Lord as well. The Reformation was growing, my friends. Denominations were going everywhere. Radicals were popping up. You started to see all of this intellectual theology be written. And then you saw this correction, mid-course correction. No, we got to walk with the Lord. This pietism began to grow in this era. Now, you may be thinking, man, it sounds like we were just going and blowing. God wasn't going to be stopped. My word, it sounds like Satan had taken a back seat. He decided, well, I got defeated by Martin Luther. All is off. The promised land is drawing nigh. But as you well know, that is not true. Satan has always had the church in his crosshairs. He hates it, and his design is to thwart it, which is why I want you to see that at the same time, the Protestant Reformation was growing. This is going to sound contradictory, but I think you'll understand why I'm saying this. It began not merely to grow, but to slow. There were some forces that held it back a bit. And I want to show you tonight, the same way I showed you that there was a theological and political and intellectual and spiritual reason it was growing, so too I want you to see that there was a theological, political, intellectual and spiritual reason it was slowing. Theologically, guess what started to happen? Do you think the Roman Catholic Church, once they saw Martin Luther start protesting and they started to see all of the Holy Roman Empire exploding in this Reformation spirit, do you think they just threw up the white flag and were like, oh, well, that stinks. We had a good run. Nah. They had a lot of money, a lot of power, a lot of capital tied up in this. They began to react. They started what we would call a counter-reformation. You ever seen protesters protesting the protesters? That's what was going on here. The Catholic Church did not like the Protestants for doing what they did, so they reacted with their own counter-reformation. Some of it was good-ish, and some of it was bad. Here's what I mean by good-ish. There was some reforms that happened within the Catholic Church. They kind of sobered up and realized, you know what, we've kind of been doing some things that are crazy. They cleaned their act up a little bit. They also began to have a missionary zeal. They sent out some people to bring their gospel all over the world. Have you ever heard of a group called the Jesuits? The Jesuits began in this era. The Jesuits, which was a Society of Jesus, began by a guy named Ignatius of Loyola. Maybe you've heard that. There's a school named after him. Or St. Francis Xavier. Y'all seen that in the Sweet 16 tournaments. This was named after these significant figures in this era who were bringing the Catholic gospel all over the world. But how many of you remember that the Catholic Church became pretty infamous in this era? Because not only were they having some good-hearted evangelistic outreach, they couldn't help but still wield what power they still had. They were still in charge of most of the Roman world. And when they realized all these citizens in their nations were not believing what they believed, they forgot and then remembered that we have political power to stop them. We can not just excommunicate you from the church if you believe in heresy. We can literally come after you with the power of the sword. And they began to do it. They began to do heresy hunts, witch hunts. Do you want to know what they are called? The Inquisition. Anybody remember that phrase, the Inquisition? It became most infamous in Spain, the Spanish Inquisition, or the Roman Inquisition. Anybody remember from school days the famed scientist Galileo Galilei? He was tried, he was put on trial by the Roman Catholic Church in the Roman Inquisition for teaching that the earth was not the center of the universe, the sun was. The Roman Catholic Church said heresy, and they put him on trial and just about took his life for teaching something that they thought was wrong. The Roman Catholic Church's counter-reformation was one that was violent often at times. So you see this first slowing of the Reformation. Yes, it was growing theologically, but it began to slow theologically as the Roman Catholic Church started killing everybody who agreed with this Reformation theology. I also want you to see that this Reformation began to slow politically. If you recall, in our first study, what happened politically as it grew? There were these reformers that were radical reformers that were all over the place, really trying to make the church stand apart from the rest of the world. Well, in this day, guess what began to happen? Since the church and the state were so tightly connected in this era, since they were just interwoven, any doctrinal dispute became a political dispute. Any theological fight became a governmental fight. You ever been in a Sunday school class here and there's a disagreement? Teacher taught something, somebody who loves to talk raises their hand and disagrees, and before you know it, there's like kind of bickering back and forth. But then at the end of the day, you know, you're going to go home and eat your bonbons and watch football and forget that you had that conversation. Back then, If you had a theological debate, it was worse than having a presidential debate. It had ultimate ramifications because your theology determined how your state was run. In fact, after Martin Luther, guess what happened? The Lutherans became so much conflict with all the Catholics in the Holy Roman Empire that they finally declared, okay, here's our compromise. If your duke, the guy who runs your part, you remember feudalism, different parts of the countries are all run by little dukes, which, by the way, you still kind of see that in Great Britain to this day. It's more honorific than anything, but there's like a guy who's rich and runs all the land around him. Well, back then they said this, all right, here's our compromise. If your duke is Catholic, everybody in his land has to be Catholic. If your duke is Protestant, everybody in the land has to be Protestant. Sounds like a compromise, except that ain't going to work. They're too close to one another, and they began fighting, and they began fighting, and they began fighting. And do you want to know what's sick? One of the deadliest wars before World War I and II, one of the deadliest wars in world history, was a war between Protestants and Catholics. For in the year 1618, a war broke out between these Protestants of the land and these Catholics in Germany. And for 30 years, they slaughtered one another, trying to get pieces of the Holy Roman Empire under their theological and political control. 30 years later, in 1648, the war was finally stopped. They had a peace treaty. This peace treaty was called the Peace of Westphalia. And in this peace treaty, they guaranteed that everybody had religious freedom as long as you were Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed. You had to be one of those three, and then you got freedom. So we historians who really wanted to come up with a creative name for this war that lasted from 1618 to 1648 dubbed it the 30 Years' War. And that's what it's remembered as to this day. Go Google it. The 30 Years' War was one of the bloodiest conflicts in world history, in European history in particular, and this conflict was between Catholics and Protestants. Just let that sober you. The rise of religious warfare. You see this warfare even spill over into England. England encountered a civil war, not basically near the end of the 30 Years' War, and in this war, basically, this is what happened. That Reformation spirit bled over into England. Parliament began to be pressured to say, hey, Parliament, you guys, you need to force the king to allow us to worship the way we want to. Well, the king didn't really like that. He likes to do what he likes to do. He's the head of the Church of England. He decided, I'm going to make the call I want to make. So one day, King Charles I decides, nah, I'm going to do it my way, but he had a problem. He needed taxes to be raised so he could do what he wanted. And in his government, he had to go to Parliament to get taxes raised. So he goes to Parliament. Well, Parliament's miffed at him because Parliament just asked him to be more tolerant towards all the Protestants. And he said no. And so guess what the Parliament said to King Charles? No. And do you want to know what King Charles did? Instead of saying, all right, you win, I lose, he abolished Parliament. Now, was that a smart move? My friends, would it be a smart move for his successor, King Charles III, who is reigning this day, to just abolish Parliament today? Wouldn't be a smart one. King Charles I got beheaded for abolishing Parliament, and out broke a huge war within England. A war broke out over this doctrinal argument, and one of the famed people that came from this war was a man named Oliver Cromwell. Does anybody remember that name? Oliver Cromwell, he was a significant figure that ultimately helped bring about a toleration of Protestantism in England. A horrible, bloody war. This is one of those facets that the Lord ultimately used, but I would describe, as I trust all of you would, this religious warfare is not something we ought to be proud of. It was being slowed theologically by the Catholic Counter-Reformation. It was being slowed politically by the rise of religious warfare. Here's the most significant one. You ready for this? You guys are tasting this today. The Reformation in the 1600s began to be slowed intellectually because it was during this era that you saw the rise of something that dominates your home, your child's elementary school, your child's middle and high school, virtually every college in America. It is hidden in the dark recesses of your mind this moment, and you don't even appreciate it. It is the reign, the tyrannical reign, in my judgment, of what we would call rationalism. Rationalism is this view that the human mind can determine everything, that we don't really need a God to reveal truth to us. It can be figured out on our own. There was a skeptical, cynical spirit that began to arise. Now stop. Why do you think it arose now? Imagine if you were intellectually intelligent, living in that day, and you were seeing all these Protestants and Catholics slaughter each other. Is your calculus going to be, I think heresy is a bigger deal than human life? Probably not going to be inclined to think that way. You're actually probably going to think religious intolerance, doctrinal intolerance, it's not as, I mean, seriously, it's a bigger threat than atheism. Atheists just stick to themselves. This doctrinal disagreement is making everybody die. In other words, this religious warfare of that era compelled a lot of intellects of that era to say, we don't need the church. All it's doing is causing people to kill each other. There's got to be another reason for all this. There's got to be another explanation. There's another factor that led to this rise of rationalism. Do you remember last week we discussed that there was in this era a rebirth of reading old books? We call it the Renaissance. There was an era when people rediscovered that all those Greeks of old actually had a lot of interesting things to say. And they went back and started reading those books. And reading those books, the printing press was invented. So people were starting to get their hands on philosophy books, and they were reading, and they were reading, and they were reading. People were gaining all this knowledge, and they began to wonder, you know what? Do we really need religion? Maybe what this world needs is not a better denomination. What this world needs is the reign of reason. We just need some smart people to get in the room and tell all of you religious bigots to stop fighting. Now, I want you to notice what began to happen. First off, in this era, there was this view called the Enlightenment, which was basically, oh, we know better than all those backwards Christians. This Enlightenment era began to call into question the utility of religion altogether. Is religion even real? Is there such a thing as a supernatural? You know what? Maybe all there is what we can see, taste, touch, smell, whatever the fifth sense is that I forgot, hear. The empirical senses. Maybe that only real stuff is what we can sense and see. There's no supernatural. We can't prove whether it is or they are not. They began to question, is there even such a thing as the supernatural? This era, this Renaissance, this rebirth of knowledge, it began to question Christianity in particular, which at that time was largely dominated by Catholicism. And they began to look at that and say, you know what? You can't trust the Pope. You can't trust these priests. You can't even trust half these denominations because they're fighting with one another all the time. Is it really trustworthy? Maybe what we need is a new gospel. We need a different message. We need something that is actually going to stabilize society, that is going to help human flourishing. You began to see this reversion away from Christianity, away from religion. And then one other thing happened that really began to poke some holes in a lot of people's faith. For in this era, there was another revolution that you all are the beneficiaries of to this day. It's what we call the scientific revolution. For in this era, guess what was discovered? Well, for one thing, we learned, thanks to Nicholas Copernicus, that the universe or this solar system revolves around just that, the sun. It doesn't revolve around the earth. Well, some people in that day really didn't like hearing that because they thought the Bible taught that everything revolved around the earth. And so they thought if you taught the earth revolved around the sun, you were a heretic. So they began to say, well, the Bible isn't true, which, of course, the Bible does not teach that we revolve around the earth, that everything revolves around the earth. Another discovery happened in this scientific revolution. The early onset of medical discoveries began to be developed. And all of a sudden, you didn't need to go to the priest to pray over you and hopefully you would survive. You didn't need to go to a mass and just hope that somehow God would heal you in that moment. You just went to a doctor. And these doctors were becoming more and more equipped to help you. And before you know it, the doctor felt actually more useful to you than God was. So do we even need this church anymore? Do we need the priest? Do we need the country parson? Does the Pope offer me anything? Because I got a doctor that'll help me. I got a scientist who's telling me what's true. And we even see this go all the way to the point where this new view of God began to arise. I bet you've heard of it before. There was a view in this day that God is not actually involved in the world. There's probably a supernatural, but he's way off in the distance, not engaged. We live in a scientific world. He built it all a long time ago, and he's gone. Do you know what that's called? Deism. Y'all ever remember hearing about deism? It's particularly noteworthy because the vast majority of our founding fathers were, to one degree or another, involved with deism. This view that God was kind of not intervening in our universe. He's just off in the distance. So do you see how the rationalism really slowed things down? Next week and the week thereafter, I feel like I'm going to devote most of our lesson to all the implication, all the fallout of rationalism, of the Enlightenment era. You're going to see why rationalism has your child around the throat right now. Why the Enlightenment is the gospel proclaimed by virtually every political leader and every TV star. That the Enlightenment is the prevailing, reigning, so-called gospel today. And I hope to teach you through church history and just through some pastoral asides as I'm teaching that it is an empty gospel. It is a false gospel. It is hollow. It is a bucket that can hold no water. It sounds good. It is enticing to your children, and it will be proven to be found wanting. So do not fall for Satan's deceptive devices to think that, you know what? Those smart people probably have something going on. This was something that slowed the Reformation, but thanks be to God, the gates of hell shall not prevail against Christ's church. Rationalism was a potent tool in Satan's arsenal, but it did not stop the advance of the Reformation. It slowed theologically. The Catholics were counter-reforming. It slowed politically. Wars were happening between Catholics and Protestants. The Reformation slowed intellectually. Rationalism began to rule the day. And lastly, it began to slow, for lack of a better word, spiritually. Because in this era, there were some crazy people that began to rise up and get what I would call mystical, which isn't a horrific word, but I just want to tell you what I mean by being mystical, mysticism. There were people that realized, you know what? I can't really get all the answers right. All these rationalists give me really good arguments against the Bible, and I don't know how to respond to them. I'm not smart enough. So you know what? Maybe I don't need the Bible. Who needs a Bible? All I need is the Holy Spirit. So there were people that began to believe that the essence of Christianity was just getting silent between you and God. Who cares what the church has to offer? Who cares what the Bible has to offer? Just quiet yourself and get alone with God. A Catholic group that began to believe this were called the Quietists. What a creative name. The Quietists. They believed in quietism, which was this belief that you just need to get quiet and commune with the Spirit. And that's the essence of Christianity. You don't need the Bible. You don't need revelation. It's this mystical, almost New Agey sort of experience with the divine. Then there was another group that you are probably familiar with. It was begun by a man named George Fox. He was in the New England. He was in the New World. And George Fox began a group of people called the Society of Friends. And this Society of Friends, they became a group of people who believed God has given us an inner light. We can just commune with the Holy Spirit silently, just us and Him. We don't need the Bible. They became known ultimately as the Quakers. There's some debate on where the name Quaker came from. Anybody heard of the term Quaker? Kind of a familiar term in American history. There is some debate on where the name Quaker came from, but most sources kind of agree that what likely led to the name Quaker instead of just the Society of Friends is that they would argue that you ought to quake before the Lord. You ought to like kind of shudder or tremble before the Lord, which by the way is a good thing. So in that sense, I'm like, well, call me a Quaker, but don't be a Quaker, because Quakerism, as you're going to see next week, is ridiculous. It is a false denomination. This is not true. It is cultic. The rise of what I would call mysticism. My friends, in the 1600s, the Reformation was growing. At the same time, it was slowing. But thirdly and finally, I want you to see it was going somewhere. It went to two particular locations that we need to study in conclusion tonight. The first place the Reformation went is to the nation we came from, England. I want you to see the importance of the English Reformation. Anybody familiar in broad brush detail on the whole story of the English Reformation? How it began with an infamous king named King Henry VIII. King Henry VIII had a wife that he didn't want anymore, and he decided, I really want to marry this girl. So he told the Pope, hey, let me divorce her so I can marry her. And the Pope said, no, that's not allowed. You got to stay with your wife. So the Pope said, I'm sorry, buddy, but you've got to stay with Catherine of Aragon, and Anne Boleyn cannot be your wife. Well, kings aren't used to being told no. And so the king said, you know what? You can't tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. So guess what he declared? The Pope is no longer the head of the church. I'm the head of the church. And guess what happened? From that day forward, the monarch of England has been the head of the church in England. Charles III, who is about to be coronated, he is the head of the Church of England. Queen Elizabeth II was for her 70-some-odd year reign. King Henry VIII was the first king self-appointed as the head of his church. Well, that essentially made him a Protestant because he was now disagreeing significantly with Catholics. He wasn't listening to the Pope. But here's the problem. Do you want to know what the Church of England basically was? It was basically Catholicism light, kind of like Diet Coke. It's just like basically the same thing, just didn't taste as good. That's what the Church of England became. It basically looked, smelled just like Catholicism, but there were a couple differences. The Pope wasn't around, and the priest could get married. That was about it. It looked just like Catholicism. And some things began to happen in England that made even that reformed movement change. Well, guess what happened after King Henry VIII died? He ended up having somebody come long thereafter him, I think two generations later, Queen Mary I. You may remember her by the name Mary Tudor, and if that doesn't ring a bell, I bet all of you know this name. She became known as Bloody Mary. Do you want to know why she was called Bloody Mary? Because she wasn't a Protestant, which is a big problem because who is in charge of the Protestant Church of England? The king or queen? But now we got a new queen who is a Catholic, and she decided to undo everything that her predecessors had done. And how did she do it? She started killing all the Protestants. She killed Thomas Cranmer, who was the head of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury. She killed him. She killed all these people, hence the name Bloody Mary, until at last she died, and then another queen arose, Queen Elizabeth I. And Queen Elizabeth I, like her heir, Queen Elizabeth II, was a stately, honorable woman who revived the Protestant version of the Church of England, Anglicanism, Episcopalianism, as we would know it today. She revived it, and it basically lasted from that day forward. However, there were a bunch of people in England who said, okay, the Catholic Church is bad, but the Church of England is just a little less bad, but it's still bad. I mean, this is not enough. It's like we've traded a felon for a misdemeanor, but it's still a crime. We need something purer. We need to purify this Church of England. We need to make this Protestant movement healthier. We need to purify the church. So there arose a group of people within England called, as you might expect, the Puritans, who sought to purify the church. We got to get this healthier. Well, do you think the Church of England liked that? Not really. And so there ended up arising a group within Puritanism who said, you know what, this is a failed mission. We're never going to be able to reform this because the king's in charge of it. How are you going to reform something the king's in charge of? Let's just separate ourselves and go do it our way somewhere else. This group were called the Separatists or Puritan Separatists. They wanted to get out of England. Some of them went to Holland, which is the Netherlands, just across the English Channel. Some of them just went over there. And this group of people that went over there, they planted a church. There were two men. One was named John Smith, and one was named Thomas Helwys. They planted the First Baptist Church. They were Anabaptists. They believed that baptism was for believers only. That was one of the great reforms they brought to the English, the Church of England. And they started the First English Baptist Church. There was another group of separatists within England that realized we need to go further than Holland. Let's go to the New World. So in 1620, a group of these Puritans, these separatists, got in a boat called the Mayflower, sailed across the ocean, and landed in Massachusetts Colony, where they, as we celebrate to this day, the Pilgrims, established Puritan Protestantism in the New World. There was, in other words, not only an English Reformation, there was what you might call a New England Reformation. For that's what the New World was. It was the New England. We still call it New England to this very day. In New England, you began to see the rise of two denominations mainly. You began to see a lot of the Pilgrims formed what are called Congregationalist churches. And if you've ever been to anywhere in New England, or even if you've been somewhere down in like Charleston, have you seen those old Congregationalist churches? That is the heritage of the Pilgrims. But there was another separatist puritanical group that was forming churches, the first one of which was started by Roger Williams in Providence, Rhode Island, the First Baptist Church in America. Providence, Rhode Island, began by Roger Williams. We, in other words, see in this century the arisal of what we now know as the Baptist Church. Now, Baptist as a denomination is multifaceted. It's all over the place. I'll have to explain it in detail in more at another time. But what I want to tell you in conclusion tonight is we are the heritage of the Baptists. We call ourselves Baptists because we can trace our theological lineage back to this group of men who wanted to separate themselves from Catholicism and from Anglicanism, from the Church of England. We can trace our line back to these radical reformers, the Anabaptists to a degree, who believed that baptism was not for infants, baptism reserved for believers. We can trace our lineage back to these men and women who sought to reclaim the faith once for all delivered to the saints. We who would say this practice of Christianity is representative of the earliest centuries of Christianity, that this right faith and practice was corrupted by the Roman Catholic Church, was corrupted by the Church of England, was corrupted even to a degree by some of these other denominations. This is where we trace our theological lineage. Now, next week, when you return, we'll, as you might expect, turn a page to the 1700s, having seen that this Reformation was growing, slowing, and going to the New World. Next week, we're going to come back and we're going to see yet again, how does the Reformation take off in the United States? That's where we are. Remember, the 1700s is when the United States begins. So part of our study next week is going to be the formation of these 13 colonies into what we call the United States of America. How did Christianity explode here? And the 1700s are also famous for what's called the Great Awakenings. What happened with all these great revivals that began to happen all over the United States? Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield and company. Who are these guys and where did they come from? Next week, we're going to learn why there was this great surge of people who started to believe all of this was ridiculous, that Christianity was just superstition. Why our universities today are the way they are. For example, do you know what college was founded in this present century we've studied, the 1600s? A college that was formed for the propagation of the gospel of Jesus Christ? A college that was formed to promote the separatist, the puritanical doctrine? Harvard University. Now, why is Harvard University, which was basically started by Puritans in the 1600s, why is it considered one of the great bastions of anti-gospel, anti-supernatural rationalism? Next week, we're going to see why virtually every public school every college and university and most of our culture is just in chains to this idea called rationalism. I hope you'll come back next week. It should be a great study together. This might be the first time ever in the years I've taught foundations that I'm ending with 6 minutes to spare. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. It's probably the last time that'll ever happen. Why don't you all join me as we pray? We'll call it a night. Father in heaven, I praise you for these dear brothers and sisters. Thank you, Lord, that they have a brilliant spirit. They want to know how you have been moving over the ages. And I pray that this study was edifying. Hope, Lord, that it wasn't too convoluted, too confusing. I pray, Lord, that it would strengthen their faith and help them connect some dots. And so would you move in this room such that we would walk in the days ahead with full conviction that we believe what we believe, we know what we know, we will indeed contend for the faith that was once for all delivered for the saints. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, guys, have a good night. See you next week.